The Book Club at 91.7 on this Saturday morning. I'm Mark Purcell. Glad to have you along. You may be familiar with Falling Water or the Guggenheim in New York, but there are hundreds of other examples of the art and architecture of Frank Lloyd Wright, and now you can find them easily with the Frank Lloyd Wright Field Guide, which includes the United States and international sites. I'm glad to welcome to the Book Club at 91.7 author Thomas Hines, who's on the phone to talk about the architect and his great structures. Thomas, welcome to the Book Club at 91.7.
Thank you for having me.
I have to confess, I grew up the son of a fan of Frank Lloyd Wright. My father started out a career as an architect, but ended up an American colonial history professor instead. But I loved Frank Lloyd Wright for many years and was curious about where your interest in Frank Lloyd Wright began.
I guess it somehow or other it began in sixth grade. I came across a book of his at our library in grammar school and read the book, thought it was interesting, didn't know much about architecture at all, but had seen a lot of buildings and liked buildings. And I guess architecture itself started with me because I could see that people didn't talk in church, they whispered. And I thought, isn't that interesting that a building affects people's behaviors? And later on in life, I could see more and more times that these kinds of things happen, that buildings, the design of a building and the use both affect people's behavior. And I thought, well, we can make a better world here by having better buildings. So let's get better buildings.
Well, Frank Lloyd Wright, well known for his buildings and working with natural materials and light, a lot of folks are drawn to his designs. What do you think Frank Lloyd Wright had that made him so popular and makes him still so popular?
Well, his buildings, as you said, I think are driven by his effect of light, natural light and incandescent light. I mean, that's what they had back then. He was at the very beginning of the electricity era, but the way he handled the light to form views, to form places for people to go who were not going to stumble over furniture and things, he was really a master at that. And I don't think very many people really understand what that is and what it says. Then number two, I think from knowing 24 of his original clients dating back to 1924, he was one of the world's greatest salesmen, and that's very important when you're an architect. I'm an architect, so I know that aspect of it. His ability to come up with a new design, it just astonishes me. I've worked on over 50 Wright buildings over the years, built some from scratch using his drawings, and restoring many other ones. I rebuilt a part of a building in the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. And when you look at his design from an architect's point of view, you think, where did he possibly come up with this idea? Oh, my gosh. It's still astonishing me.
I had, of course, seen lots and lots of pictures, but finally had the pleasure and the joy of experiencing Falling Water in person just recently. And just how everything fits into the environment, how the light comes in, the views, everything that he truly was a polymath who considered so much and arranged it so nicely.
Absolutely right. His integration of all of the different systems, the structural system, the lighting system, the heating system, everything was so integrated, and it made it very efficient, besides making it beautiful.
I'm speaking with Thomas Hines, author of the Frank Lloyd Wright Field Guide, published by Northwestern University Press. You can learn more about it at our website, wvxu.org. And I have to say, Tom, this is quite an endeavor here. This is a field guide, much like a nature field guide with birds or mammals or trees or flowers, but with Frank Lloyd Wright creations, buildings. What started you on this catalog process, I suppose you could call it?
Well, I had seen almost all of them before I started the field guide. And I had been associated with a group of people out in Oak Park that took over his home and studio out in Oak Park. And the first year that we had it open, we had 30-some thousand people show up. And then I went through and I thought, well, this building is open and that building is open. So at that time, back in the 70s, 1 million people a year saw Frank Lloyd Wright buildings. Now it's over 5 million a year. And I thought, how many people have I talked to who try to see every Frank Lloyd Wright building? Now, some of them don't know how to get there. Some of them aren't very good with maps. So I thought, well, let's get something that people can use. So how do people use it? They use it geographically. In other words, they're somewhere and they go somewhere else. So let's arrange this geographically. And I thought, well, let's start in Seattle and end in Florida. But then going all the way back around the world, I've been in Japan several times and over in Europe many times, and had started working with Architectural Digest back in the 1970s. And so I thought, let's get people to these places. That's why we have maps, we have directions, we have GPS numbers, we have all of those things. But the text of the book itself, I thought it was very important to discuss the clients, because it's the clients who paid for this, paid for the building to be built, and Frank Lloyd Wright was trying to please. Now, I know a lot of people think that Frank Lloyd Wright was very stiff about what he would and would not do. And in talking with these 24 clients, I find that to be exactly opposite. He was so accommodating. Many of these people came back to him two or three times for other buildings. Some of them weren't built, but they still went back to him because he was so accommodating to everything they wanted. One client in particular, who I was in their living room talking with them, and they said, see over in the hallway over there, how that the height of the ceiling in the hallway? Yes. Well, we hate it. I said, why is that? Well, Frank Lloyd Wright tried to get us to raise it, and we said, no, 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 we like it like this. So he tried and tried and tried, and they just weren't going to budge. So after it got built and they started living in it, they just couldn't stand it. And I thought, so he really knew what he was talking about. And they said, oh, yes, everything else we went along with him, but that one we just couldn't do it. So when you see in the early years, like in Oak Park, one of the houses on the street that Frank Lloyd Wright himself lived on and has about seven of his own designs has no stained glass. And it was built right in the middle of his stained glass era. Well, found the family. The family knows that the woman, the wife of Mr. Beachy, hated to clean stained glass windows. There's hundreds and hundreds of little tiny pieces you have to get in and with your Windex clean them out. She didn't want that. So she didn't get that. And that started me thinking about the effect of the client with the architect. Because you're not going to have a client pay for something he doesn't want. He's not going to write that check. They always got what they wanted. This also applies to what people have heard are excessive costs. Oh, Frank Lloyd Wright was two times over the budget. But still, the building got built, and the client paid for it. So it wasn't that Frank Lloyd Wright made it over budget. He said there's nothing like a mortgage to keep people working hard, which I certainly can understand.
Yes.
He tried to have them spend every dime they could possibly come up with so that maybe at the beginning they were able to squeak by, but later on they could really begin to appreciate what he had done for them and what they could live in. And a couple of these people were teachers who literally had no money. They had to decide if they were going to build a Frank Lloyd Wright house and have the world come to them or travel. So they built their Frank Lloyd Wright house, and literally the world has come to them.
The buildings in the field guide, I mean, they range from houses. We talk a lot about the houses, but there are a lot of other types of structures that you include in the field guide that Wright did. Of course, you know, we think about the museum, we think about the Guggenheim, but there was also a synagogue, a college, too.
Yes. He did a full college in Florida, where the head of the college just was so enamored with Frank Lloyd Wright and his ability to do things. Personally, I don't really care for any of the buildings there. And I think the design of the college is really not very well done. But he was able to convince the president of the college that this was the greatest thing on earth. And I guess I'm glad he did it. And my purpose in doing this is also so that we inform the people in the neighborhoods and the towns and the villages and cities that have these buildings so that they will have a greater interest and help preserve these things. Now, I started a graduate program at University of Illinois in Urbana a couple years after I graduated about how to preserve buildings. I don't necessarily think that every Frank Lloyd Wright building needs to be preserved. But I think we need enough of them to be put back to their original condition so that people can really see what Frank Lloyd Wright was all about.
Well, we have some examples very close here in Cincinnati. As a matter of fact, three houses that Frank Lloyd Wright designed exist here in Cincinnati. And we must point out that here in your field guide that while this is a good compendium of all the structures, it also indicates which ones are open to the public and which ones aren't. And I love how you also note the accessibility. The house can be seen from the street or the house cannot be seen from the street.
Well, that's important when you're trying to set up a trip to go see Frank Lloyd Wright buildings. My rating system, which has stars between 1 and 5, tells you how much effort to make to see this building. Whether or not it's easy to see or whether, mostly I don't deal with how good the building is, but how accessible it is. And Cincinnati has one in particular, which I think is one of the great buildings he ever did, the Gerald Tonkin's house over in Amberley Village. It is just a great, great house, great site, well preserved, even though it had some problems along the way. But I tried to talk about the client in here, Gerald Tonkin's, born in Milwaukee in 1919. And it's an 1,800-square-foot house designed in October of 56. That's when they first moved in. Designed in 1953. And he had almost 3 acres of land. I mean, it's just, it's a great, great building.
I didn't
realize. Boswell, too, over in Indian Hill, talked all about his family and the sons and daughters and stuff, and that he was in World War II fighting for our country and things. And these are things we need to know about how the building reflects the people who had Frank Lloyd Wright do it.
And I noticed there's another cluster of three Frank Lloyd Wright houses up in Canton.
Yes.
How do they compare to the ones here in Cincinnati?
Well, they're pretty good houses, too. And they all knew each other through music, which I was pretty astonished. And I met two of the three original clients. They were still involved with music. I think they're all gone now. Nathan Rubin's wife, I knew pretty well. She did a book on something that Frank Lloyd Wright acknowledged affected his designs over time. It was the Froebel system, and she really did this incredible book on Frederick Froebel, who started kindergartens back in Germany. And in Italy and in Holland, for instance, they still use that Froebel system in how to teach children about design and about forms and about abstractions and things. So she did this book, and oh my gosh, it was just amazing. They both went to the Juilliard School in New York and obviously were terrific musicians. So the three of them would get together. They would get together all the time and have musical sessions. And they were just, what an incredible group of people these were. The Feynman House in Canton is based on a house Frank Lloyd Wright did that was on the original site of the Guggenheim before the Guggenheim was built. They needed to get another piece of land before they could have the whole front of the block on Fifth Avenue there. And so Frank Lloyd Wright came up with this design, and he used it several times with variations around the country, also in Iowa. It's a great design. It has a brick wall out on the street, but that's because that's what the clients wanted. But the backyard, the huge backyard of that house, is beautiful to see, and it faces south. So he took advantage of the whole thing.
I have to say there are so many stories here and some great photographs. And for Frank Lloyd Wright fans and fanatics like me, this is an endless source of pleasure. And I appreciate you doing all the work to pull it together and taking the time to talk to me this morning, Thomas.
Well, let me mention one other thing about this. This book was put out 10 years ago. And you think buildings, okay, buildings sit in one place and people take care of them or don't take care of them. Well, I'm coming out with a new edition. There are so many changes to these buildings, it's astonishing to me. We have found in the last 2 months two more buildings in Wisconsin, one in Milwaukee, one over in Madison.
Wow.
Buildings have been moved. Buildings have changed. Buildings have been torn down. The Mercedes-Benz showroom in New York City, one weekend, they went in, tore it out. It's gone. No notice. And so many changes to these things. It's just amazing to me. So I have to go back, take new photographs, because some people have painted their buildings or whatever it is, or added on to them. So I want everybody to recognize what these buildings are. And these are not necessarily the greatest photographs, but so many things have changed on these buildings that we have to come up with a new addition. So I don't know when it's going to come out. It's a lot of work.
Well, I have to say, there's a ton of work in here, too, but it really shows, and what a fine book it is. And again, thank you. I can't wait for the new edition, I'll have to say, though. I'm not looking forward to be disappointed about progress robbing us of some of these buildings, I have to confess.
Right, I know.
Well, thank you again for your time, sir.
Thank you.
Thomas Hines, he's the author of The Frank Lloyd Wright Field Guide. Published by Northwestern University Press, it includes all United States and international sites as well. For Frank Lloyd Wright fans, it's just an amazing work. You can learn more about it at our website, wvxu.org. This is the Book Club at 91.7. You've been listening to the Book Club at 91.7. Technical director for the show is Rick Andres. Producers Kevin Reynolds. Assistant producers Catherine Cunningham. Web guru is Jim Doland. And I'm Mark Purcell. Adult coloring books have become all the rage, touted for ability to calm and soothe busy modern life. The queen of adult coloring books, Johanna Basford, shares why next time. I'll talk with Nancy Marie Brown about her book, Ivory Vikings, The Mystery of the Most Famous Chessmen in the World and the Woman Who Made Them. And you'll learn about the Year of Fear, Machine Gun Kelly, and the manhunt that changed the nation. I hope you'll be here next Saturday for the Book Club at 91.7. Weekend Edition is next on WVXU.